Welcome to Human Emotion. Today we're going to look at the question of how do emotions shape our everyday choices? This is our third series on judgment and decision making, where we'll look at emotion and choice and answer the question just alluded to of do our feelings actually shape the way we make choices in everyday life? So here's a quote that I'd like to read with you. It says, "The capacity of the human mind for formulating and solving complex problems is very small compared with the size of the problems whose solution is required for objectively rational behavior in the real world." So this was a quote by Herbert Simon, who won the 1978 Nobel Prize in Economics. And I want to now think about, when we think about the rational human mind, how does this relate to the way we make choices, risk-taking, and the following in our roadmap today. And in particular, we'll look at the role of emotion and how it shapes the way we make choices. How does emotion shape the kinds of risks we're willing to take as well as those we're not? So let's start with this concept of making choices, and can our emotions actually shape the choices we make? So first I want to begin with the question of is choosing always rational? So economists assume that humans are rational, right? They put human beings in the equation and they say, okay, well, the steps in rational decision-making that humans should follow should be as follows. You clearly define a problem, you gather the relevant information, including alternatives, you identify the evaluation criteria, you weight the criteria against given goals, evaluate each alternative on each criterion, and select an alternative that maximizes criteria. But if you put human beings in the equation, are they always following these rational decision-making steps? And if not, why? So what we find is there's, on the one hand, the rational model assumptions that we kind of went through earlier that include considering alternatives and comparing their probable outcomes, using absolute standards and factual information, and really systematically always evaluating alternatives simultaneously. And when we're making choices, choose the one with the higher payoff. But what we find is that real life decision making is not always rational, right? And real life organizational evidence suggests that instead, on this right-hand column, we see that we have limited information processing capabilities, and often we only consider a small set of alternatives. Instead, we have an implicit favorite, and so we process facts in different ways. And we evaluate alternatives sequentially, and often just choose the one that seems to be, quote, good enough. So we don't seem to always operate in these rational ways when we make choices or make decisions. So it seems that the rational model assumptions may not be correct. And let's start here with this concept that might help illuminate this, which is the paradox of choice, right? So we know that when people are offered too many investment options for their savings, they have difficulty choosing, right? And choosing and often wind up not saving at all. So here's an example from the paradox of choice that you find that when people are given a set of 24 jars of jam, only 60% will actually approach, and only 3% will actually buy any of these jars. Whereas if they are sampling from a smaller set, as you can see here in the picture, of only 6 set of jams, 40% approach, but 30% buy, right? So it's almost as if when we have fewer choices, we're more likely to actually choose to buy something. This seems a bit paradoxical, right? And doesn't seem to follow this rational model of decision making. So people think that there's these different processing systems we have for making choices, and I'll walk through these right now. And I want you to think about which of these two systems might be most heavily influenced by our own emotions. So this is really work that was laid out by Daniel Kahneman, who laid out what he talked about as a system one, which is a more intuitive system, versus system two that's more effortful thinking, he would say. So let's go through a few examples here to illuminate the system one versus system two distinction. So here's a question I want you to consider. A ball and a bat cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. So how much does the ball cost? Think about it for a second. Okay, what we find is that when people answer really correctly, the intuitive system, they'll say 10 cents. But if people sort of think more deliberately, we know that the correct answer is actually a dollar, right? 5 cents plus $1.05. Let's go through another example. It takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets. So how long will it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? All right, go. How many of you answered the intuitive answer, which is 100 minutes, versus the correct answer, which goes, each machine takes 5 minutes to make a widget, so in 5 minutes, 100 machines will make 100 widgets. So we're seeing this kind of distinction between these two systems already, the intuitive system and what might be the more effortful system leading to a correct answer. Finally, here's the last question. So, in a lake, there is a patch of lily pads. The patch doubles in size every day. If it takes 48 days for the patch to cover the entire lake, how long would it take for the patch to cover half the lake? All right, go. What would you guess? How many days? The intuitive answer many people often give is 24 days, while the correct, more deliberative or effortful answer is actually 47 days. So, again, this is this distinction between our system one, which is an intuitive system, and system two, a more effortful system. So, the point here is that you're most likely to be affected by framing when you're in a system one mode. So let's go through this other example here. So imagine that the United States is preparing for an outbreak of an unusual disease that is expected to kill 600 people. Two alternative programs have been proposed. Assume that the exact scientific estimates of the consequences of the programs are as follows. Program C, 400 people will die. Program D, there's a one-third probability that no one will die, and a two-thirds probability that 600 people will die. So people are often asked, which program do you prefer? And as I said earlier, the point is that you're often affected by the framing of these programs, right, when you're in a system one intuitive mode. And actually, these two programs are objectively the same. However, changing to a loss frame dramatically shifts preferences towards risk-seeking behavior. So people are typically risk-averse when it comes to gains and risk-seeking when it comes to losses. So you can see here, if you frame them differently, how does that change what kind of program you want to pick? Program C now says 200 people will be saved, right? So again, changing it now to a gain frame dramatically may shift your preference towards which of the programs you're likely to prefer. So when we think about emotions, we know that strong emotions seem to promote more system one thinking and decision making. So this accounts for things such as framing effects, sunk costs, escalation of commitment, auction fevers, and leadership decision making studies, right? So interestingly, what we're seeing is that really fascinatingly, our emotions seem to promote this more automatic and intuitive kind of decision making and influences the kinds of choices that we're making. So we've talked a little bit about making choices and this distinction between system one, more intuitive, and system two, more sort of effortful types of processing information and ways of making decisions when it comes to simple sort of calculations on a cognitive reflection task, as well as more important decisions when it comes to which kind of program are you going to evaluate and choose when it comes to saving lives. How does it then influence risk-taking? We've alluded to this a little, but let's delve into this a bit more and think about how does emotion shape choices such as the kinds of risks we're willing to take versus those that we're more aversive towards. So we think about risk-taking. One of the studies that has often gained a lot of attention here comes to sexual risk-taking. So this is a study by Dan Ariely and colleagues called the Heat of the Moment, the Effect of Sexual Arousal on Sexual Decision-Making. So his abstract reads, despite the social importance of decisions taken in the heat of the moment, very little research has actually examined the effect of sexual arousal on judgment and decision-making. So here, we examine the effect of sexual arousal induced by self-stimulation on judgments and hypothetical decisions made by male college students. So let me walk you through his provocative study. So here, you had male participants enter the lab, and they were assigned to one of two conditions on either the top or bottom row. So one was a self-stimulation condition, so they were assigned to that condition via masturbation or a neutral state where they literally did nothing. Then they were given images sort of a sexual nature and after asked to answer questions indicating how appealing they found a range of sexual stimuli and activities, both visual and written questionnaires. Finally, at the end, and here's what's really interesting, they described their willingness to engage in unsafe sex. So this is the risk-taking willingness box you see here at the far right when they're aroused. And the results are really fascinating. So you see that increased sexual arousal in the moment, so this is our self-stimulation condition, when compared to a neutral condition, impacts profound areas of judgment and decision-making. So the heat of the moment really seems to change the kinds of risks that we're willing to take. So you ratchet up the emotional arousal in the sexual domain, and we'll be more likely to take all kinds of risks. So you can see here, for example, higher scores in the aroused or self-stimulation condition compared to the neutral condition across a whole range of questions, right? So you can see the different scores here. So people who are in this more sort of heat of the moment aroused state rate higher on items such as, can you imagine having sex with someone who is extremely fat? Can you enjoy having sex with someone you hated? Is the smell of cigarette smoke arousing? Would it be fun to tie up your sexual partner? Do you prefer to kiss, have sex with the light on, or is kissing frustrating? So there's a range of questions here. And then what gets really interesting are these more risk-taking questions. Again, we're seeing individuals who are induced into a state of sexual arousal are more likely to do things such as apply pressure sexually. So would you keep trying to have sex after your date said no? You know, would you slip a woman a drug to increase the chance that she would have sex with you? So they're more likely to engage in sort of sexual coercive behavior, as well as more likely to take risk-taking choices when it comes to safe sexual practice. So they would say endorse, you know, for example, let's see, a condom decreases sexual pleasure. They would agree more with that. A condom interferes with sexual spontaneity. They would agree with that too. Would you use a condom even if you were afraid that a woman might change her mind while you went to get it? Right? So they're more likely to both apply sexually coercive pressure, and they're more likely to endorse questions that are associated with unsafe sexual practices. So we know that emotional arousal, especially in the sexual domain, will actually profoundly influence the kinds of decisions people make when it comes to important social and sexual practice related behaviors. So what about emotional valence and other kinds of risk-taking behaviors outside of the sexual domain? So we know, just broadly speaking, that positive or happy faces actually make us more likely to take risks, and negative and angry faces make us least likely to take risks. So there's something about the positive valence domain, generally and specifically with respect to sexual arousal, that increases our likelihood of wanting to just take risks and go for it. It's almost as if positive emotions release our emotional brakes. Thinking about our earlier lecture, you know, we've talked about emotional brakes in the domain of emotion regulation as well as in the domain of adolescence. And that positive emotions really seem to just release these inhibitory brakes, whereas negative emotions maybe actually seem to help us apply inhibitory brakes and make us less likely to engage in risk-taking behaviors. So now, with our brief introduction we've had today to decision-making and choice selection as well as risk-taking and the role that emotion plays, we're going to turn to our takeaway questions. So first question asks, how do rational model assumptions versus organizational evidence differ in the approach to human decision making? Second, can you describe this distinction we talked about today between system one and system two processing, and which of these two systems does emotion seem to most heavily impact or influence? And finally, how do emotional arousal and emotional valence influence risk taking? Of both a general variety and of a specific kind of variety related to sexual behavior and sexually safe practices that we talked about today. So now with our takeaway questions, I want to turn to our expert interview to conclude our lecture for today. So this is part of the Experts in Emotion interview series. We'll have to cut that out later. So today for our Experts in Emotion interview series, we'll be speaking with Dr. Michael Norton on consumerism and emotion. So Dr. Norton is an associate professor of business administration in the marketing unit and a Marvin Bauer fellow at the Harvard Business School. He holds a BA in psychology and English from Williams College and a PhD in psychology from Princeton University. Prior to joining the Harvard Business School, Dr. Norton was a fellow at the MIT Media Lab and MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's the co-author, along with Elizabeth Dunn, of the book Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. His work has been published in a number of leading academic journals, including Science, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Psychological Science, and the Journal of Consumer Research. His work has also been covered in media outlets, including The Economist, The Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. Dr. Norton has also appeared on the National Public Radio and written op-eds for the New York Times, Forbes, and the Los Angeles Times. His research has twice been featured in the New York Times Magazine Year in Ideas issue in 2007 for his work on ambiguity promoting liking, and in 2009 on The Counterfeit Self. His The IKEA Effect, When Labor Leads to Love, was featured in Harvard Business Review's Breakthrough Ideas in 2009. In 2010, he won the Theoretical Innovation Prize from the Society of Personality and Social Psychology. In 2011, he won the Sage Young Scholars Award from the Foundation for Social and Personality Psychology. And in 2012, he was selected for Wired Magazine's Smart List as one of the 50 people who will change the world. So I now turn to our Experts in Emotion interview with Dr. Michael Norton on consumerism and emotion.